Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Minkin. I am a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And today I'm really honored and really excited to be interviewing Dr. Esther Rollhaus, who is also a proud JOMA member. If there are topics you want to hear, if you want to be interviewed, if you know someone you want to hear being interviewed, if you have comments on any episodes, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. We want to hear from you. I will also add, I mentioned during the podcast, that this is a very broad and deep topic, and this is primarily an introduction to it, and I plan to do more interviews related to it to really flesh it out. Dr. Esther Rollhaus is a board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist. A graduate of Stern College for Women, Esther received her medical degree from the Icahn School of Medicine and completed adult psychiatry residency and child and adolescent psychiatry fellowship at Montefiore Medical Center. She is an adjunct professor at Stern College for Women of Yeshiva University in the psychology and biology departments. She also consults on reproductive and women's mental health issues to Achieve Behavioral Health in Muncie, New York. Dr. Rollhaus owns a private practicing children, adolescents, and adults in person in Riverdale, New York, and via telehealth in New York and New Jersey. Welcome, Dr. Rollhaus. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I am so, so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, thank you for coming on with me. I am super excited. And as we talked about before, this is going to be more of an introduction to a really broad and really deep topic. And so I just want to start with, I love your line that, you know, like we say, children are not mini adults. We can also say women are not smaller men. And I'd like you to explain what you mean by that, please.
Absolutely. So I started out in child and adolescent psychiatry fellowship. And one of the tenets of that teaching is that children cannot be extrapolated. The psychiatry of children cannot be extrapolated from adult psychiatry, that there's something unique that's quantitatively different about children. And it's so important to extend that to women as well. Most of the psychiatry that we have, the traditional psychiatry, has been formulated around men. And we know that women have monthly cycles. They have hormonal fluctuations throughout the lifespan. There's puberty, there's often pregnancy, there's postpartum, and there's perimenopause. And those are unique lifespan occurrences for women that don't occur in men. And they're actually serious mental health repercussions for those, for accounting for those reproductive hormones.
Wow. Yeah, I want to go through a lot of that. Let's talk a little bit about these major hormones. We're talking estrogen and progesterone here.
That's right. Yes. So throughout the lifespan, there are tremendous fluctuations. And so we can start even with puberty, where you're getting someone who's non-pubertal, who essentially has a very similar hormonal makeup to the boys of the same age. And then all of a sudden, there are surge and cyclical surges of estrogen and progesterone throughout the month, which can cause a lot of dysregulation in terms of mood and anxiety. And we know that these hormones are incredibly powerful and very active in the brain. Progesterone and estrogen are psychoactive, which means that they actually have effects on the neurons, the brain cells themselves. And so there actually can be mood and anxiety implications for that. And so within the monthly cycle, we can see that there are fluctuations that account for what we call PMS and sometimes PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, about 2 weeks before the period, where there's actually moments of irritability, sometimes depression, dysphoria, that can really affect somebody's mood, you know, affect their family life, affect their job performance. It's incredibly powerful. And then thinking about you know, in pregnancy, where there are tremendous drops, right, tremendous increases in estrogen and progesterone, and then postpartum, tremendous decreases in those levels as well, can create a lot of like mood and anxiety fluctuations as well.
You know what I'm thinking? How do you know what's primary? Is it the mood issue? Like, do you have a mood issue first and the hormone fluctuations make it worse, or the hormone fluctuations themselves causing the mood, or could it be both?
You know, it's interesting. I don't think science has a clear answer about that, but I'd actually want to propose, you know, and this is the way I'm thinking about it, that the hormones themselves really have a tremendous impact on the neurotransmitters, on the nerve cells themselves, on the chemicals that influence mood and anxiety. And so there's really something to be said for that, because we see a profile of some women who are very responsive in terms of mood and anxiety to fluctuations, to either rapid increases or rapid decreases of their hormone levels.
But it wouldn't be based just on the hormone level itself, right? Because you might say, well, just measure the hormones and then you'll know.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's not that. We don't know why this happens to people. And so there, you can have someone who's really suffering from postpartum depression. And if you were to measure their estrogen and progesterone levels compared to somebody who wasn't suffering, they would look the same. You can't diagnose based on hormone levels. And so we don't actually know why. There are some people who are more sensitive to these fluctuations in hormone levels.
It's the fluctuation. It's the changes, not the level.
Correct. It's actually that there seems to be some vulnerability in terms of brain chemistry to those changes.
But it would still be different if you had a predisposition, right? I'm still trying to dig in and say, you know, there's got to be people who are at higher risk, right?
Exactly. We know that. And so having a history of mood disorders and beginning anxiety disorders definitely increases the risk of the vulnerability to mood and anxiety disorders with the changes of the levels.
But could you have someone who has a mood disorder who's not particularly susceptible, and then someone who doesn't have a mood disorder who it's purely hormonal? Is that possible? I'm asking hard questions because
I'm
curious.
Yeah, those are really hard questions. I don't know. I don't know if science, you know, really knows exactly how like the mechanism by which the hormones are affecting the brain. But we do know that there are some really powerful effects. And it is possible. We see people who have had mood and anxiety disorders throughout their lives, and postpartum, they're doing fine, right? They aren't getting it. And people who out of the blue, who we don't, you know, who have not been flagged at high risk because they haven't had mood and anxiety disorders, are actually presenting postpartum.
Right. I've heard also even in perimenopause, that you can have a new onset mood disorder, which is crazy.
I know. And so even by the way, schizophrenia, right? So we're talking about mood and anxiety, but sometimes there are people who are getting diagnosed with ADHD or with depression for the first time, or even with schizophrenia for the first time in their 50s or in their 40s or 50s as they're going through perimenopause.
Right. I think one of the big problems is we just do not have enough research on this.
I agree. And this goes back to this idea that women are not small men.
Right. Meaning the research is on the men.
Is on the men. Exactly. And I
don't have these hormonal fluctuations like we do.
They don't. Exactly. There's a, you know, consistent amount of testosterone throughout the life cycle. They're not going through the same kinds of reproductive changes that we are. And so most of psychiatry historically has been focused on men and thinking about neurotransmitters and brain chemistry in themselves, and not really thinking about the hormonal implications for what hormones do to the brain.
But right. What do we understand about the interaction of the hormones and the neurotransmitters? We're talking primarily serotonin and dopamine at this point, right?
Yeah, and some GABA too, which has some anxiolytic anti-anxiety effects. Mm-hmm. And I think there are more getting discovered every day in terms of effects of glutamate, you know, different norepinephrine, different neurotransmitters. So we know that estrogen and progesterone protect against apoptosis or against the degradation of some nerve cells. We know that they help with some of the supporting cells around neurons, like glial cells. There's really a lot in terms of like BDNF, which is some of the some of the chemicals that support nerve growth. And so there's emerging research that there really are mechanisms by which estrogen and progesterone are affecting the brain.
Wow. I mean, I've heard of it referred to as the neuroendocrine system.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So we need more research on this.
We really do. There's, I mean, it's so interesting. What's emerging is that even within the monthly cycle, when there's a surge of estrogen, there actually seems to be some cognitive functions that are improved.
Wow.
Right? On a subtle level, right? But even within the month, you're seeing cognitive effects of these fluctuations. These need to be studied, right? We need to know more about this.
Right. And people are going to ask, well, what about treatment, right? That is so complicated. I'm going to say right here that we are not endocrinologists. We are not gynecologists. And I do plan on doing a talk with a gynecologist, particularly about perimenopause and menopause and hormones, because that is a multiple podcast, probably. Definitely not this one alone. We can't do it.
Yes, but we do know, and I'll say this as a psychiatrist, you know, from some of the research, we really do know that hormonal treatments can improve some of the psychiatric symptoms. So thinking about some of the, you know, premenstrual exacerbations of mood and anxiety disorders, sometimes putting someone on an OCP, an oral contraceptive, can actually smooth that out. And often we will recommend someone going on an OCP, an oral contraceptive, if they are suffering from premenstrual exacerbations.
And can we talk a little bit more? Because when you say OCP, there's so many types. And I think that when you're talking about mood, you really got to be specific.
Yes. And this is also an area of emerging research, of really trying to understand what combinations are recommended to help with the mood and anxiety effects. And it's something that's really interesting and emerging. So we know that IUDs, the copper IUDs, can help prevent the period, but they don't have the same hormonal implications. But we do know that IUDs can, some even like Kylena, Mirena, some of the hormonal IUDs can stabilize mood. And there are some contraceptives that actually worsen mood. Right. And so sometimes OCPs aren't necessarily the answer because you're getting negative mood effects. We've all heard those stories that often are poo-pooed, right? That aren't necessarily believed when somebody comes in on oral contraceptive and can't stop crying or has low energy. Right. And so it's kind of both, right? And it's incredibly complicated.
Right. I will say that I send to a specific gynecologist who's interested in the interaction of mental health, right, and gynecology for OCPs for patients that do have mood issues, because I do know that they interact.
They do.
That the choice really matters. And it's going to matter more for someone who has a pre-existing mood disorder.
Absolutely. I also refer out to one of your former guests, Elisa Hellman, Dr.
Oh,
Lisa
sure.
Hellman.
She's fantastic.
Shout out to her. She's amazing. And so often... You know, I don't have the expertise to say this, you know, this ratio to progesterone and estrogen, but I do believe that's incredibly important for mood. And so I will refer out to a wonderful gynecologist like Elisa Hellman.
Right. And I don't want to get, you know, too deep into, you know, which parts of the oral contraceptive affect mood in different ways. But I don't know if you want to just mention briefly the progesterone versus the estrogen.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's
because the reason I'm saying this is because I know that there are what they call the mini pill.
Yes. Yes. The mini pill can be very problematic for some people. They tolerate it perfectly well. And often people will choose to go on the mini pill while they're lactating because of concerns about estrogen's effect long term on lactation and the fetus. And again, like the quality of lactation.
You say mini pill, though, you mean progesterone only, right?
Yes, progesterone only. And often or sometimes you can see real pro-anxiety effects from unopposed progesterone, or you can see really depression. And so often that, you know, when you think of a mom who's crying while she's breastfeeding, can't stop crying. A lot of people will say, oh, it's because she's lactating, because she's postpartum, right? And kind of say that's normal. But often you want to ask about what contraception she's taking. And often the mini pill does not work for some people who are at risk.
You mean for mood disorders?
Yeah, sorry, for mood disorders.
Right. You know, just so happens that just this week they came out with the first over-the-counter oral contraceptive.
I know.
And it's progesterone only, isn't it?
Controversy.
Isn't it progesterone only?
Yeah, because there are real concerns about prescribing estrogen, right? In terms of breast cancer risk, in terms of DVTs, clotting issues.
Right.
Like, you know, there are concerns, but I'm curious to see what's going to happen in terms of some of the mood implications of a progesterone only pill.
Concerned. And there's no counseling given, just as there would be no counseling for estrogen. Now there's no counseling for mental health.
Right. Right. Because you can just get it over the counter. And so you're not even interfacing with a physician who can tell you what to look for.
Right. So PSA.
Yeah. PSA. Exactly. I would use it with caution. I really would.
Right. Again, especially if you have, you know, underlying mood disorder. Absolutely. I keep saying that because yes, you can get one de novo, but I would think most of these, there would be a predilection or even pre-existing symptoms.
Yes. And so if you have had a mood disorder, you are more likely to develop a mood disorder in these periods of vulnerability, like pregnancy, postpartum, perimenopause. But there are some other, you know, interesting risk factors as well, you know, family history, specifically of any mental illness, but also of, you know, period or menstruation, reproductive related issues also puts you at risk. And there's really interesting data about trauma, specifically sexual abuse, putting people at risk, putting women at risk for some of these issues, specifically mood-related exacerbations, you know, premenstrually. And we don't know why, but it's a four times increased risk.
But what did you think? I mean, again, I'm really speculating. We have to say what we know and what we don't know, and we don't know the answer to this. But if you think of neuroendocrine as a system, right? Trauma affects all your systems.
Yeah, right. The HPA axis.
Right.
So cortisol, the way that interacts, we really have to understand this better.
Right. It's so true. And, you know, we talked about this before, but it's so frustrating that I feel like we don't value mental health the way we do physical health. Like when I was trying to read up to prepare for this talk and I was looking about, say, menopause and perimenopause, there was endless information about hormone treatment of hot flashes. Mm-hmm. Very little about mood.
Yeah, they're really. And it's so unfortunate because we see this happening.
Right.
We do see women who are, you know, perhaps at risk, but perhaps de novo, who are developing, you know, psychiatric conditions in perimenopause. And that's not talked about. It's not talked about. And so often people will attribute it to psychosocial factors, like, you know, you're getting older, some of the discrimination, right, can be certainly very, you know, impactful on how women are feeling about themselves, body changes, you know, empty nest, right? All those life cycle psychosocial factors are interacting or are intersecting at the same time as perimenopause. And I don't mean to, you know, discount them. Those are very powerful. Right. And there are hormonal changes that we do need to take into account at that time.
Right. You mentioned the double stigma of age in female. And then I'm going to add the triple stigma of mental health. And I think we're kind of conditioned to, you know, not really focus on our own wellness.
Yeah.
In terms of advocating for ourselves. So even if you get one thing out of this, you have a right to feel good at every stage of your life.
Yes,
mentally
you
and
do.
Physically. You do have a right.
You do. Yes, you do. And, you know, and perhaps science is lagging behind or medicine is lagging behind in helping you do that. But for you, for the listener, to take control and advocate for your mental health, right? And trying to think about the influence of hormones, throughout your lifespan, and thinking about how you can get help for these various periods of vulnerability.
Right. So how can you get help? And we talked a little bit about the proper choice of an oral contraceptive if you're using that earlier on, especially if, you know, you have mood issues.
Yeah. I mean, I would see a psychiatrist, right?
Okay.
And there are some of us who are reproductive psychiatrists who specifically focus on this. And so focus on, you know, who focus on menstrual issues throughout the cycle, who focus on pregnancy, postpartum, and perimenopause, but everything throughout. And so that is something I want to destigmatize of,
right?
You need to go, it's okay, right? It's okay. We know this is happening, and that's okay to get help from a psychiatrist. often will prescribe antidepressants, and they can be incredibly powerful in those periods of vulnerability.
Yeah, we need to talk about this more because there's a couple of things I want to unpack here, right? The first part is to respect your mental health just like your physical health, right? It affects everything. And I don't know why we have it at some lower tier, right? Or this idea that it's somehow not real. It's all in your head.
Yes.
It's not.
No, you know, I was telling you before the, you know, before we started recording about a case that I had where I explained to someone who was going to through perimenopause about the influence of hormones and specifically on her very, very severe new onset of depression. And she said, "Oh my gosh, thank you. It's a physical explanation. It's not my fault."
But
neither is depression at all. Even if it's based in neurochemicals or in other factors, that's also not your fault. And so sometimes the suggestion that it's hormones that are at play can be very reassuring, but I want to say it's okay if that's also not what's happening. Depression is never your fault.
Exactly. And it's just as real.
Yes,
it's not less real. And we may not understand how to measure all of these things. But just because you can measure something doesn't mean it's more real than something you can't.
I agree.
It's just more tangible. That's all. But not less your fault, or it's not more your fault if you can't measure it. It sounds so obvious, but I feel like they need to say this because this is what I deal with as a pediatrician all the time. There's like a different tier of problems, these mental health problems, right? People look for physical explanations over mental health explanations, but I keep saying it's not either or.
Right.
It's not like you have a brain floating on a stick away from your body.
Exactly. You're right. Exactly. Your brain is an organ in your body.
Right.
And it interacts with all the other organs. And if there are chemical fluctuations, or we don't know exactly what causes depression and anxiety, but we do believe it's based in something about the brain.
Right. But okay, back to hormones. Okay. So we're saying, okay, well, what if there are hormones that are causing, because we have said that, you know, again, we don't know enough to really be specific about this, you know, how much is the hormones, how much is the mental health problem, how they're interacting, but why not just treat with hormones?
There sometimes are options in terms of, we mentioned in terms of the OCPs or sometimes hormone replacement therapy, but often that's not sufficient. And the recommendation in terms of really helping with these, you know, conditions is antidepressants, are psychiatric medications that we know are very efficacious, even if it was prompted by a hormonal event or hormonal change. It's mediated through the brain. And we know SSRIs work in terms of changing and altering brain chemistry. And so, you know, it's not as often, it's not enough to treat the hormones. We need to be thinking about what's going on in the brain and treating with the tools that we have in terms of our medications.
Right. I'm going to link to the talk I did with Dr. Tal Weinberger, who's also a reproductive psychiatrist.
She's the best. I just want to give her a shout out. She's the best.
So are you.
Thanks.
You guys are rock stars because this is really, you know, a new field. And it's so important. I mean, women's mental health through the lifespan, that's huge. But anyway, back to Dr. Weinberger, we were talking about medication. And I'm going to link to that talk so we don't have to go into it as much. But I do want to discuss a little bit about medication because there's so much stigma against medication.
Yes, and so much misunderstanding about the effects of medication, about what it's doing. People are often worried it's going to change their entire personalities. And what I say is, it's helping you be you, just minus the depression or minus the debilitating anxiety, right? And so we're not seeing personality changes, we're seeing alleviation of symptoms. And I firmly believe that.
Right. And it's all a matter of function, right? So it would be on a spectrum. Like you may have someone who goes through perimenopause and has some mild mood swings and hot flashes. And maybe for them, hormones replacement, you know, HRT would be enough.
Mm-hmm. And I'll add in psychotherapy as well, right? So
right.
We're talking here about medications, but throughout the lifespan, psychotherapy is incredibly, incredibly important. And that could be sufficient for somebody who's going through, you know, mood exacerbation in perimenopause. Something like CBTI, which is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, can help with some of the insomnia, you know, the perimenopause or the postpartum related insomnia issues. So for some people, that's sufficient.
Right. That's presuming you can get it and afford it, though. I just want to put that out there.
Yes. And the access to it is so low.
Right.
So it's so difficult to access.
So, you know, I do want to say that, you know, hormones or hormone replacement therapy is very controversial. Mm-hmm. There's also the whole field of bioidentical hormones. We are just not going to talk about it in this talk. It is beyond the scope. I think I will talk about it with the gynecologist when we talk about menopause and perimenopause in greater detail. But I do want to say it's really important to say that there are risks mm-hmm. to hormones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a risk of exacerbation of estrogen receptive breast cancers. Mm-hmm. There are the risks of the DVTs, the clotting disorders that we had talked about. There are risks, but they also need to be weighed against the benefits. And we right. do know that there really are benefits in terms of some of the vasomotor symptoms, meaning the night sweats, the the flushing, that really can be powerful. And actually, there's research that says that the worse the vasomotor symptoms are, the more likely the woman is to have mood and anxiety issues. So there is something very powerful about treating those vasomotor symptoms in affecting mood and anxiety.
Right. But I'm thinking that people may say, okay, it's just hormones. I go to someone, they tell me it's just hormones. Then what?
Like it's just hormones as the solution?
It's just hormones as the cause and it's just hormones as the solution. Because I don't think that this is the case across the board. I mean, we've been talking about this.
Yeah, I think it's that's an explanation that's much easier to accept.
Right.
Right.
And simpler. We like simple.
And we like simple. We like simple. And there's nothing simple about our brain. There is right. nothing simple about that wonderful organ and the way it interacts with the rest of our bodies.
Right. Right. I mean, this neuroendocrine is incredibly complex, understudied and incredibly complex.
Exactly. And if you're just treating the endocrine part, you're missing out on the neuro part in terms of what we can do to optimize brain functioning.
Right. Optimize is the key here, right? So if you have, I mentioned before, an example of mild hot flashes and some very mild mood changes might alone be, you know, say in the perimenopausal period, fixed with a hormone replacement therapy protocol under the, mm-hmm. you know, wise eyes of a healthcare professional who's adequately trained for that, I might yes. add.
Agreed.
But someone with more significant mood issues may think, okay, it's my hormones, it's perimenopause, and it may not be adequate. And then, by the way, there's the risk of having greater risks of higher levels of hormones, right? Would that be fair to say, or am I being inaccurate here? Because I'm not a specialist in this.
I think it's the hormones that impact the mood. I don't necessarily know that the mood impacts the hormones. Yeah, I don't really know about
that. No, I wasn't talking about exacerbating the mood. I was talking about increased risk of cancer, DVTs, and all those things.
Oh,
so
yeah.
if you're saying, I'm going to give you more estrogen.
Oh, right.
And you're not doing an SSRI, but the person has a significant mood disorder, that I think is a risk.
Absolutely.
That's what I meant. Sorry.
Tremendous. Yeah, no, that's okay. A tremendous, tremendous physical risk. And again, you're ignoring a very important avenue for treatment. And when we're thinking about this, it's a range, the same way that the vasomotor symptoms or the physical symptoms are a range. We're thinking about this in terms of functional disturbance.
Right.
How impactful is this on your life? Right. And for some people, you know, they can get through it with, you know, a diet and exercise, let's say, right? Or some of those, you know, think positive.
Yoga. Yeah, I want to talk more about that. That was my next thing to get into. And I don't want to be dismissive of these things because it's really all a matter of function. For some people, that can be all that they need.
Right. And then psychotherapy, again, do not want to be dismissive. That for every level of functioning, right? Or every degree of functional impairment, that can be such an important part in terms of processing these tremendous lifestyle and life cycle changes, right? There's so many psychological impacts for going through these stages. But then there are some people who can't get out of bed. Right. And there are people who are functioning, but are miserable and are very irritable with their husbands, with their children, and not able to, live up to how they want to be. Right. And there's no judgment with that. Again, this is something that happens, that we know happens, and it's nobody's fault. And we know how to treat that. We have SSRIs, we have antidepressants to help people with that.
Right. And in all fairness, because there is, you know, problems with access to psychiatrists, right? I mean, it's often not covered by insurance. I just want to be completely transparent here.
Yeah.
And you should be able to go to your OBGYN or your primary care health professional and also access an SSRI there. You know, I want that out there as an option so people don't think, okay, well, I tried and I called a psychiatrist and there's a 1-year wait list or they don't take my insurance, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there needs to be a little bit more training, you know, if I may suggest.
No, for sure.
Just for those primary care physicians or for OBGYNs to feel more comfortable prescribing. And I see very common that there, and I'm impressed that there are wonderful, I'm seeing people being treated wonderfully by gynecologists, you know, by primary care physicians who don't need to come to me, right? The cases that I'm seeing are the ones that are more complicated. And then you do need to see psychiatry.
There right. That's really, limits. Yeah, that's really, really important for the primary care or OBGYN to know their limits.
Right.
It would make sense if they see the simpler cases and they refer them more complicated, but then they have to know that they're more complicated.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I'm seeing just wonderful examples of that because the referrals that I'm getting are the ones that are more complicated, right. The ones who didn't respond to Zoloft 50 or Zoloft 100, right? And so they need a little bit more of you know, psychiatric expertise.
Right. Or have more pronounced mood swings, not just mood disorder, right? We're talking maybe bipolar or something like that. I don't think that should be treated by primary care or OBGYNs.
No. With all due respect, they're doing wonderful work in their field, but bipolar disorder or, you know, some of the other conditions that are a little bit more complicated, even like obsessive compulsive disorder, psychosis, I do believe that has to go to someone who's trained in psychiatry.
Right. Absolutely. That's really important. I want to talk for a few minutes about screening, because in order to treat something, you have to know it's there. Not everybody walks into their doctor's office and says, I'm here because I'm depressed.
Yes. It's right. It's hard, right? It's hard to sometimes tease out what's going on and why someone is not feeling very well. What I'm very impressed about is a lot of the screening protocols that have come into OBGYN practices. For example, there's a PHQ-9 often that's given at the 6-week check-in, right? Which is not going to cover everybody. There are often symptoms that present later, but at least there are really efforts to pick up on some people who are struggling. And the same thing is true with a lot of pediatricians who, you know, in addition to looking at the newborn, are looking at mom and screening how she's doing.
Right. We do the EPDS.
That's wonderful. Oh, really? Yeah. That's long to administer.
No, it isn't. Okay. EPDS, it's a paper screen. It takes a minute to score.
Oh, okay.
The parent
okay.
fills it out before they come in, ideally.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's like 10 questions.
Yeah. Okay, good. No, I'm happy to hear that. I think that some of it is like, I was assuming that there was a PHQ-2, right? With just those you know, are you feeling depressed? Are you feeling suicidal? But I'm so glad to hear that the screening is more thorough.
Yeah, no, I don't know what they do in the OBGYN's office. I thought they did the EPDS as well.
Yeah, no, it could be. And I'm so happy then to hear that there is such rigorous screening.
Right. The only problem that I see with the EPDS is it screens more for depression than anxiety. And we really haven't talked about postpartum mood changes. But, you know, there's certainly, I see more anxiety than depression, and it doesn't pick it up as well.
That's right. And let's take a second to talk about postpartum anxiety, because that can also be very debilitating, and it doesn't get the same acknowledgement as depression.
Oh, I should link it to my talk on that.
You have one? That's fantastic.
Postpartum anxiety and postpartum depression separately, two different ones.
That's fantastic. Yes.
Yeah, because, I must link.
Perfect. They're different and they're distinct. Sometimes they come together, but you can sometimes have just postpartum anxiety, which often is very specific to the postpartum period, where you'll have mom checking on the baby multiple times, making sure the baby is breathing, having intrusive images sometimes, the baby, some harm coming to the baby. Also very common to have intrusive images of mom harming the baby themselves, which is often horrifying and very scary to mom. And sleep issues related to anxiety. So everyone says sleep while the baby is sleeping. Well, first of all, I have a lot of issues with that. Just, you know, in terms of creating a false expectation.
Right.
Sometimes mom cannot sleep when the baby is sleeping. Mom is too anxious. Mom is too worried. Mom is too keyed up to be able to fall asleep. And that needs to be addressed.
Right. And as a pediatrician, you know, we're not nosy. We're not asking moms these questions because we want to, you know, butt into their lives. It's because it affects our patients.
Yeah, it does. It does. There are really a lot of attachment implications for PMADs, for perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. And so we know it's much harder to attach when you're worrying about the baby all the time, or when you're having a hard time functioning, getting out of bed. There really are implications for the babies.
Right. But it's so important to detect it and treat it. And, you know, definitely for attachment, but for everything. I mean, how can you possibly function, you know, when you're a ball of nerves?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. And any pediatrician can tell you we're seeing a ton of that now.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I don't know how much of it is COVID, you know, just general anxiety. Like they're going into the pregnancy with a higher level of anxiety, which we said before, that puts you at risk for postpartum.
Absolutely.
I mean, why wouldn't it be? Now your hormones have fluctuated, right? And the world is anxious.
Yes. Yes. And one of the biggest risk factors for postpartum issues is our mood and anxiety issues in pregnancy. People often don't realize that. And so often these issues are presenting pre-birth. Right. And so I'm so happy that there are celebrities who are talking about, you know, postpartum issues. And I want to extend that to talk about issues in pregnancy and then issues on other parts of the lifespan in terms of the monthly cycles and perimenopause, which really does not get talked about enough.
It really doesn't. What is that? I don't get that. I found like nothing on it.
I don't know. I think there was one celebrity, I might be misquoting, I think it was Brooke Shields, who made a statement about her experiences in perimenopause. But this is rare, right? We've really seen celebrities come out and talk about PMADs, talk about pregnancy-related issues. But I don't think that we're really giving enough attention to, you know, perimenopause. And I think that has to go with your triple stigma statement.
Right. And back to screening again, right? I read that I think a third of physicians do not screen perimenopausal women for mood disorders. Everybody should be screened, honestly, at every, you know, well adult visit.
Yeah.
Because it's super common.
It is. It is. And I, you know, I would hope that, you know, OBGYNs who are seeing these individuals to help with the perimenopause, who are prescribing hormone replacement therapy, are also thinking about the mood implications and what else can be done to optimize the mood.
Right. Absolutely. So I think this was amazing. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add. And like I said, like, this is just, I'm so grateful to you for opening up this really important subject, but we're going to have to do lots more interviews from different angles to really flesh it out, I think. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, there's so many components of this, right? And even taking any one of those life cycle events and having a whole episode on that and thinking about the intersections of hormones and neurotransmitters, you know, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. And I think it's bringing a new level of validation to a lot of people who are struggling.
Right. And I think if you have one takeaway from this is understand that your mental health is at least as important as your physical health. And if you have issues, speak up and get help. Don't be, you know, hesitant. Don't think that it's somehow your fault in some way, because of course it isn't.
No, it's really, really not. It's really, really, really not. And the same way we think about cardiovascular disease and we think about, you know, just other conditions, hypertension, right? This is something that is going on in your body. And because it's more complicated, it's harder to accept because it's more amorphous. It's harder to accept, but that does not make it any less important.
Right. And one more plug for medication. I mean, I have no ties to big pharma here. Okay.
For the record, neither do I.
Right. And so I say this only because I see the benefits of medication and it hurts me to see the resistance. What we didn't talk about that I meant to, but I left out, but it's okay because I've done it in other talks already and I'll link them, particularly the one with Dr. Weinberger, and I can go deeper with her on that too, is, you know, parents often will say, I'm breastfeeding, I don't want to go on medication, or they're pregnant, they don't want to go on medication. And this is where reproductive psychiatrists shine.
Yes, yes, because there really is a lot of safety data for a lot of the medications, and there are variations medication to medication. And so often I'll do a lot of preconception counseling where helping the patient optimize their regimen pre-pregnancy, but there is a lot of misconception about, you know, about safety of medications in pregnancy. And what I always say is you're not prioritizing your mental health over your babies. Right. I think about you guys as both of my patients.
Right.
And we know there really is evidence that the better mom is doing, the better the fetus is going to be doing.
Right. Right. It's a risk benefit that has to be assessed individually. And this is why we have psychiatrists, but also even OBGYNs can often handle a lot of this, and not to be afraid to speak up and to learn about what your individual risk benefit ratio is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right?
So much more to talk about. We could talk all day, but I want to thank you so, so much for doing this with me. This is amazing.
Alisa, I'm so glad, so grateful for the opportunity.
Oh, you're amazing. I really appreciate it. And have a good Shabbos. Good luck to you both of us. We're getting ready now.
You too. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.